Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our weekly EAN podcast. My name is Barbara Tettenborn. I'm the editor-in-chief of eLearning. And my today's guest is Professor Matthias Endres. He is professor and chair of neurology at the Charité Hospital in Berlin, Germany. He's also on the board of directors at the Center for Stroke Research in Berlin. His major research interests are preventive vascular mechanisms, mechanisms of cell death, regeneration and functional outcome, post-stroke depression, telemedicine, and most relevant for today's talk, heart-brain interaction. He's also a member of the German National Academy of Sciences Leopoldina and visiting professor at the University of Oxford in England. Well, hello, Matthias. Thank you very much for taking your time today to have our podcast.
Good morning, Barbara. Hello.
Our topic today is stroke and cardiology. Stroke is not only a matter of brain, as the title. So let me start with the most common cardiac pathology leading to stroke, atrial fibrillation. There is a novel clinical concept regarding atrial fibrillation. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay, yeah, thank you, Barbara. I think stroke and heart has manifold interactions, bidirectional interaction, as we will hear today. But the most important link, of course, for all the stroke neurologists is that the heart causes strokes, and that has to do with heart failure, and that has to do with atrial fibrillation. And I think over the last 10 to 20 years, neurologists have learned when treating acute stroke patients at the stroke unit to take care that atrial fibrillation diagnosis is performed tediously, and that very good care is taken, that patients are monitored, and that everything possible is made that atrial fibrillation is diagnosed. Typically, the thinking is there is a stroke patient. Once I find atrial fibrillation, I have found the cause of a stroke. And that may be true. And the consequence, of course, is that the patient then needs to be anticoagulated. The new concept, however, and that has to do with something we will talk about later, I think it's part of the so-called stroke heart syndrome. The new concept is that not only atrial fibrillation can cause strokes, but vice versa, strokes and the associated brain injury can cause atrial fibrillation. So the stroke itself, by activation of stress systems and neurocardiac signaling, can cause atrial fibrillation. And that's called AFDAS, atrial fibrillation diagnosed after stroke. So it's an acronym, and it's dissociated or differentiated from atrial fibrillation that was present before the stroke. And the key question now is whether the relevance of this newly diagnosed stroke-induced atrial fibrillation is the same than for atrial fibrillation that was present before the stroke. And the preliminary evidence indicates that it may be different, that the risk associated with atrial fibrillation diagnosed after stroke may be lower.
Okay, that's interesting. I always consider a day where I didn't learn something new not a good day. So today is a good day already for my side, because I learned something new about the risks after the stroke regarding the heart. So you mentioned it already. We will talk about the stroke heart syndrome. It's one of the fashionable words in the moment. And is there anything else behind that apart from the atrial fibrillation post-stroke you mentioned already?
Well, if you go one step back, I think it's been known for a long time that acute stroke patients are patients at high vascular risk, not only for the coming years, but for the next few days and the next few weeks. And in particular, there is a large increase in the risk of cardiac events after a stroke. So it's increased 20 to 30 fold. And it has become clear that the stroke itself in the next few days in a relatively high proportion of stroke patients can cause cardiac injury. And a few years ago, we and others have made a definition of a so-called stroke heart syndrome that in the mildest case can just take the form of some sort of elevation of biomarkers, such as troponin elevations in the few days after a stroke. But this can also take other phenotypes, such as heart failure, fibrillation, atrial fibrillation, or other arrhythmias, or even a phenotype that resembles an acute coronary syndrome. And then there is always the question, is this stress-induced? Is it something like a Takotsubo phenotype? Or is it related to cardiac ischemia? Is this really a myocardial infarction? So stroke heart syndrome refers to a situation in the first few days after a stroke with cardiac injury, arrhythmias, heart failure, and acute coronary syndromes.
Okay, so I mean, we know for a long time already that the risk of a second stroke is particularly high after a first stroke or after any stroke in the couple of days and weeks afterwards. And you just said that now the risk of a cardiac event after stroke, which is kind of a new information, is also very high. And you mentioned a number which is so extremely high that sounds to me even higher than the risk of a second stroke. Is that correct?
No, the absolute risk for a second stroke on average in the first year after a stroke is on average 6 to 7%. We know this from the TIA registry from Pierre Marenko, and that is with full secondary prevention. And that is not a constantly increasing risk, but the risk is higher in the first few days and then still largely elevated in the first 3 months, and then it levels out. The absolute risk for cardiac events is lower when you think of heart endpoints, but still, I would like to cite two studies. One is by Luciano Sposato, looking at large number of patients. It's a registry in Canada, where he demonstrated that stroke patients compared to age-matched elderly population, of course, have a largely increased risk of cardiac events. And this risk is elevated more than 20-fold in the first months after a stroke. And another study comes from the group of Gregory Lipp in Liverpool, published by Buckley in Stroke, where they looked over the first 4 weeks after stroke for cardiac endpoints. And the highest incidence was atrial fibrillation and acute coronary syndrome, and this was highly relevant.
Thank you very much for this clarification. I think that's important to know for our listeners. Is it necessary to make a differentiation between just like a regular cardiac infarction after a stroke versus a stroke heart syndrome, or is that the same?
If you look at troponin, then it's a very sensitive measure of cardiac injury. Troponin is specific for the cardiac muscle. Elevations can also be caused by renal insufficiency, so it's not always indicative of a myocardial infarction, for example, but it's a specific cardiac biomarker. And if you look at stroke patients in the acute phase, 1 in 2 patients have a relevant elevation of troponin. Then a cardiologist will always ask, is it a chronic elevation or is it an acute elevation? And for this, you need to do a repeated measurement. You need to look for so-called rise-fall patterns. About 1 in 7 patients have a rise-fall pattern, have an acute elevation of troponin. And if we then look at some sort of troponin elevation that would fulfill the definition of a acute coronary syndrome, we find that 1 in 7 stroke patients have that type of cardiac injury that would be compatible with the cardiology rule-in criteria for an acute coronary syndrome. So that would justify invasive diagnostics, for example, a coronary angiography. In an individual patient, and that's a large dilemma, and it's very hard to predict this. It's almost impossible to say, just from the biomarkers and just from the clinical presentation of this patient indeed now has an acute coronary syndrome with a myocardial ischemia, or whether that patient has a stress-induced Takotsubo-like stroke heart syndrome. What is important, however, is to know that whatever the mechanism exactly, outcome in stroke patients with troponin elevation is poor. Whatever the underlying pathophysiology, these patients over the next year have a much higher risk for secondary vascular events and death. And to basically differentiate in an individual patient, right now the only way is to talk to a cardiologist and, if in doubt, to perform invasive diagnostics to really differentiate patients with stress-induced myocardial injury from an acute myocardial infarction. To this end, we have recently finished the PRAISE study, which looks at these patients, stroke patients with troponin elevations that fulfill the rule-in diagnostic criteria for coronary angiography. The results have been presented at last year's ESO conference. And what we demonstrated is that 50% of these patients have a myocardial infarction, and the other 50% have no evidence of coronary heart disease and have a stroke heart syndrome. That makes it even more difficult in the future now in an individual patient to decide what exactly to do. Yeah.
You mentioned troponin several times. Are there any other laboratory markers to measure which are important for the stroke heart syndrome or the connection?
I mean, troponin is the most sensitive and the best biomarker for cardiac injury. There are other cardiac biomarkers, but they are more related to function or other conditions. So I would say for stroke heart syndrome, it's the ideal biomarker. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Thank you. Next question would be, I heard that the insular lesions in the brain play a special role for the stroke heart syndrome. Can you maybe tell us a few things about that?
Okay, so if you think of a stroke heart syndrome as a situation where you, for example, have a perfectly healthy heart, so the coronaries are normal, so how would a brain injury lead to cardiac injury? And that's a situation that is not exclusive for ischemic stroke. What we're talking about today can also cause of a hemorrhagic stroke, in particular after subarachnoid hemorrhage, which induces a lot of pain and stress, also brain trauma and what have you. And the idea is that the crucial mechanism of action has to do with the central autonomic network, with some sort of changes in the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system that then induces stress systems in the periphery, noradrenaline or the HPA axis, but other humoral factors. And if you look at the central autonomic network in the brain, the insular cortex plays a crucial role. And as we know, as stroke neurologists, the insula is part of the middle cerebral artery territory. So in many MCA infarctions, the insula is involved. And there might be some differences between the right insula and the left insula. One may be more related to the parasympathetic nervous system and the other to the sympathetic nervous system. But in essence, there is a clear statistical finding that if a stroke involves the insula with a slightly more preponderance for the right non-dominant side, there is an activation of the central autonomic network and the likelihood of a stroke heart syndrome is largely increased.
That underlines again the importance of the autonomic nervous system, which we might have underestimated in the past, I think, for several diseases, not only for the stroke heart syndrome.
Yes, it's a for, forgotten discipline in many ways. If you now look for experts of the vegetative nervous system, you have to dig deep and you find literature from the 1960s. And I think there will be a huge revival of this literature in the near future.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, it's an interesting part. It also plays a role in sports and neurology quite a bit. So that's a topic I'm into it at the moment a lot. You mentioned the connection between cardiologists, all the tests we do, and neurologists. Would it be a good idea, actually something we put into action in St. Gallen a couple of years ago, to have a cardiologist as a steady co-worker within a neurological department?
Oh, okay, that's an interesting question. I think that goes beyond the stroke heart syndrome. And I think what that shows is that it's an interdisciplinary approach in how to best tackle such organizational and intellectual issues that is up to the colleagues in a given situation. We at the Charité have a very good cooperations with our cardiology departments. And if you work next to each other, that can also be a lot of fun. The question of whether to have a cardiologist on board in a stroke unit and vice versa, potentially also a neurologist in a cardiology department, I think is a decision that has to be made by a given hospital. I think a cardiologist could perform echocardiography. He could perform daily routine when it comes to monitoring evaluation. There are a lot of interdisciplinary questions. I mean, most of the stroke patients don't only have a stroke, but they have a systemic issue with the vasculature and with the heart. So there's a lot to do for a cardiologist. I personally, I'm not such a big fan of having, you know, the one expert in a given unit. I rather have a standardized good cooperation with a fully functioning cardiology. And vice versa, I would not personally prefer to have a neurologist as part of the cardiology team or in a heart center, but rather have the neurology department provide services on all levels to cardiology. So I am rather a fan of having the expertise within a given department rather than kind of having individuals from another discipline in one team. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point. And of course, we don't want to have one individual's meaning on a certain topic, but we want to have a group of experts taking their best possible knowledge on the topic to give between cardiology and neurologists. So I think that would be the best available connection between cardiology and neurologists, but we have to work together very, very.
Absolutely. I mean, these are not silos that are separated from each other, but there is a lot to learn in cardiological diseases, heart failure. These patients have, you know, issues with cognition, with affective disorders, also a very high burden with chronic cerebrovascular lesions. So these patients should be evaluated by neurologists and being taken care of in an interdisciplinary manner and vice versa. I think stroke patients need good care by cardiologists. Let me give you another example. I mean, stroke neurologists look at the heart mostly with the question, is this the cause of the stroke? So if we have the rhythm monitored or if we have echocardiography performed, we only or often only look with the question, what's the reason of the stroke? But we often forget that, you know, there may be heart disease by itself and that heart disease needs to be treated, even though it may not be the cause for the stroke. And I think that's often forgotten in our routine. And I think patients could receive better treatment if we look at patients more holistically and not only for the one disease that is now acute. Yeah.
Thank you very much. That's a very nice statement for the finish of our podcast. Thank you, Matthias, for taking the time. And I'm sure we will have the topic of cardiology and neurology again, a very tight connection. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.